and where were you born, and what was your name when you were born?
My name was Norbert Kuttner, and I was born on 13th of January 1924, and in a place called Chemnitz, Chemnitz, in Germany. Chemnitz is near Leipzig.
Yes, I was going to actually ask where it was near.
Saxony.
And your family, in fact, were they Germans, or had they moved to Germany?
No, my parents, for the worse, were Poles. So we were really Polish Jewish emigrants from Poland. I was born in Germany, though.
Now, I've heard before about your early years. I know that you had the most exciting set of experiences that eventually did lead you to the UK. So would you like to tell us a little about them?
Yes, most of them are in my book, but since the listeners probably won't have read the book. Well, first of all, in Italy, under Mussolini, we were refugees from Germany to France to Italy, because France was just as bad. In Italy, we came under Mussolini, of course. And there my brother, not I, got into political trouble, and he spied for the French. So he was caught by the Italians and put in jail at the age of 19 or 20, I can't remember. And he was sentenced to 30 years imprisonment.
What was he doing? In what way was he spying?
He was spying for the French and sending information from Italy on, this is unbelievable, he was told to count the number of military aircraft, bomber aircraft.
Can we go back again now, where maybe I should have begun with what happened after, I suppose it must have been after Hitler came to power in Germany. How did it affect your family, and then what then happened to you?
To the best of my recollection, remember I was 9 years old, 10 years old, Polish Jews, foreign Jews, knew that they were in for a hard time under Hitler, who had come to power in 1933. Mm-hmm. German Jews thought they were safe. They'd been in the war fighting for Germany. They'd had their medals, their ribbons. So they thought, oh, we'll be all right. But these bloody dirty Jews from the East, let's get rid of them. Believe me, the German Jews were as pleased to get rid of us as the Nazis were. So my father had to make the decision to stay or run, and we ran, which was the best decision he ever made, because they caught up with the German Jews soon after. So we left Germany, and by the way, stop me if it's too detailed. We left Germany and went to France, to a small town called Lunéville. It was a charming little town. I remember it as a little boy. It was a lovely, idyllic life, everything a child could want, including a wonderful school where I learned French from the bottom up with no difficulty. I found that I can sing, but I can do languages. So I went to school there, learned French pretty well, made a lot of childhood friends, and then my father went broke. He started a little business by the way, in Lunéville. My father was quite good at going broke, as I found out in later years. So we moved to Paris, thinking that was salvation. And as many people know, Paris was as anti-Semitic as anywhere else. In fact, it was highly organized anti-Semitism. The only thing is, it was never officially recognized. The difference there was they didn't give you labor permits or permission to do anything, so you starved on your own quietly. I discovered, but that is afterwards, there was a Jewish refugee organization which took care of young kids like me. In my case, they sent me to Switzerland to stay with a Swiss family for a few weeks. And I fell in love with them. They were very good to me. So I went back to France, the same misery. You know, I can see that. By the way, we had one room and kitchen for the five of us. But when you came in at night and switched on the light, the bed was covered in lice. Have you seen lice? They're little, tiny, black things. I think they were black. And the minute you switched on the light, they disappeared. It was like by magic. But the next morning, all the blood spots were all over the sheets. Oof. This I had clear vision of. And I was 10, 11 by then. Anyway, that was an awful life. Awful. And my father couldn't get permission to work. So what little money we had, if any, went. Then my father got cancer. And cancer in the middle 30s was something else. It's bad now, but it was...
Death,
it was unbelievable. His death sentence anyway, and he was taken to a hospital that looked like something out of the movies. Really horrible. I went to see him. It was very hard. Well, then when he came home again, he came home to die. Mm-hmm. And I do remember it just happened to be the last one with him. And he looked at me and said, Norbert. He died. Another memory, the definite one. Anyway, then the misery started in because we had no money. We couldn't live. My mother took in lodgers. Well, it doesn't kill anybody, but she had to take in lodgers who took up most of our bedroom space in our flat in Italy. By the way, life in Milan had been pretty good until this thing with my father. And then it became terrible. And then Mussolini started...
You were in Paris.
Oh, sorry. Of course. Well, we left Paris with great difficulty. Oh, no, I'd been sent back to Switzerland again to those lovely people, and I stayed with them for 6 months. And I had to start school all over again. Not the language, but the history, the geography, everything, all from the bottom. You always started in the bottom class, but was promoted very quickly to my own level. So that was Switzerland, 6 months of bliss. What a wonderful family. The guy was quite an important big shot in his own village. And it was lovely. And they were good to me. And then I got word from my parents not to come back to Paris, but to go straight to Milan. Uh-huh. And I started school again there, again from the bottom. All of it, the language, the whole works. Again, it didn't come to me very hard. I wasn't a particularly good student, but languages, yes. So that was life in Milan. And for a couple of years, it was great till my father got cancer. Then everything collapsed. As I said, my mother started taking in lodgers. And
you,
when
had, you mentioned five of you. Were you
brother, sister.
Brother, and were you the oldest?
My big brother, no, I was the youngest.
Right.
My brother was 6 years older, my sister 4 years older.
Right.
My brother was very much the leader. In every kind of mischief, he was the leader. So anyway, and the Mussolini thing was very difficult because, although to begin with, life in Italy was lovely.
Mm-hmm.
The Italians didn't know from anti-Semitism.
Mm-hmm.
Had no idea. Didn't want to, I think. But then suddenly, because of pressure from Hitler, Mussolini introduced an official anti-Semitic policy.
So you were in Milan.
Yeah, this is the high or low point of our family life, really. My brother got himself sort of conscripted, tempted into the French Secret Service. It started out by him, he didn't like our way of living anymore. My father was dead, it was hard to live, he didn't like responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
He liked women, that was his hobby. He was very handsome. So he went off to France. To get to France in those days, if you were a Jew and if you were under those laws that Mussolini had introduced, you weren't allowed to move freely. You were ordered to leave Italy, but there's no way you could go because the countries all around Italy wouldn't take Jews.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So there was nowhere to go, but you had to go. It was a terrible time of panic, quite a few suicides. But then my brother decided, he joined the French, first of all, the Foreign Legion, which was nuts, that's not a job for a Jewish boy. Then he was lucky enough, because of his languages, he was singled out and put into French Secret Service. They trained them. And he came home, he never told any of us what he was doing, he couldn't. But when he eventually got into trouble in 1938, I think, or early 39, we were all destitute.
Mm-hmm. So, Bob, you talked about the fact that you had accompanied your brother on the back of the bike.
Yes.
And then you said at that point that actually, how was your brother found out?
Because he was an idiot. He played a juvenile game of spying and didn't realize just what he'd got into. I think he must have been approached by some French guys, undercover people, who sold him the idea of becoming a spy for France. That was a time when we already were under Mussolini and Ciano persecution, which of course was inflicted on Jewish refugees in Italy. So he probably chose, I don't know if it was patriotism or a young man's adventure.
Excitement. Mm.
So he did join the French Secret Service, which was ludicrous. The whole thing was like an Enid Blyton story. Unfortunately, it didn't end like that. They, after a few months, they arrested him. But before they did, my brother got me involved. I was 15. But he needed an errand boy. The idea of his spying, by the way, was to count enemy aircraft, Italian aircraft, mm-hmm. on Italian airports. Actually go around counting them, literally. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It was laughable. And he kept records. Now, no spy in history has ever kept records. But because he had me as his errand boy, Don Quixote and Sancho Panza, guess who was Sancho Panza? He had me as his errand boy. He actually got me to write down records of what he had done. He used to send his reports to France written on plain paper with lemon juice, which you may not know. Lemon juice comes to light when you heat it from underneath.
Right.
So that was a secret writing. It was heated. He sent these messages to France, and I kept copies, which he hid in the back of a wardrobe. This is a spy keeping records, unheard of. Anyway, we used to cycle around Milan, Sancho Panza, again, behind Don Quixote, till he was caught. I think, remember this, I can't guarantee, I think he was caught because some girlfriend or other, he had a legion of girlfriends, some girlfriend or other actually told on him.
Right.
So one day, the secret police came to our house. I remember just coming in when they took him away. They came to our house, thumped on the doors, and my mother let him in. She was terrified. She had no idea what these men wanted. But they went straight to a cabinet where my brother kept these records. Now, somebody must have told him.
Yes, they wouldn't have known that they were in the cabinet. No.
I think it was a girlfriend. Again, this is conjecture. Anyway, they arrested him, and I didn't see him again for many, many years. He was taken away for questioning, and that was the last we heard of him for quite a while. Meantime, my mother and I were arrested as well on suspicion of complicity. My poor mother had no idea of what we were doing, no idea. She'd have killed us if she'd known anyway, but I knew. So when we were taken away for questioning, we were kept in a place like this, like a cellar. Mm-hmm. And it was very tough at 15 to be cross-examined by the Italian secret police, the OVRA, O-V-R-A, I think it was called. So anyway, they kept me there for 2 days and two nights. Terrifying, absolutely terrifying. What they made me do was everything I'd written in my handwriting, these copies of the reports, they made me write them 3 times to make sure that it was the same person who had written it, me.
Right.
After about writing it, about, they were smirking, they knew anyway. But after 3 times of doing that, which spread over 2 days and two nights, they let me go. And my mother was getting the same treatment. They let her go eventually. But they sequestrated our passports, and that's the beginning of the problem.
Right.
We had Polish passports. It's important one should know that Polish passports, unlike German passports, did not have that stamp, J for Jew, in them. So that I wasn't quite a suspect with the Germans. I'm telling you that for a reason. So now we eventually struggled to get our passports back. By a miracle, we got them. And in the same time, I had taken a job as an errand boy in an organization, a committee for Jewish refugees. You know, we Jews form committees.
Oh, we love committees.
Yeah, but we're very good at them. But that was the reason I did that was I'd been thrown out of school in common with all Jewish refugee children. There was no exception. Maybe they don't know about that in Britain, but no child stayed in school under Mussolini oblique Ciano, the foreign minister who was also Mussolini's son-in-law.
Right.
So he got his position because he was a son-in-law, because Mussolini did what he wanted. Anyway, Ciano prescribed us no school, no job, no occupation of any kind, 6 months in the country, get out or lose all your chattels, the lot. You were given 6 months to get out. The only thing is most of us had no chattels worth talking about because we were already refugees from Germany via France to Italy. So we were really quite skint. Lived in very difficult conditions, and we had nowhere to go. And that was the next problem, which many Jews experienced. We couldn't get out of Italy. We were supposed to get out, but France wouldn't have us. Even on transit visa, you were a Jew and a foreigner. No chance. No chance. I mean, none. Going through Switzerland itself was risky because the Swiss were sending their Jews back to Germany in some cases. In some cases. All the countries that bordered north of Italy, Austria, obviously, which was Germany by then, they were all close to us. So we couldn't get out of Italy, but if we didn't get out, we were in trouble. Under those conditions, I got this unofficial illegal job with this organisation for refugees. I was an errand boy. And while I worked there, no other job to be had, this Jewish couple with a little girl, probably about 9 years old, kept coming up every day because they had been promised by an English gentleman that he was going to get this child and take her back to England under his sponsorship. And they came, and they came, and they came, and it was tragic because the people from England didn't arrive. It's just the parents came with their daughter every day. And eventually that couple and the child decided they couldn't wait any longer. And what was the practice in those days, not practice, frequent practice, was to try and get over the border illegally. The easiest way was over the Alps from Italy into France at night, dangerously, with a guide. And as far as I know, and I will really never know, is what happened to those parents and that child. But I assume they may have made it to France, they may have died in the mountains. I don't know. In a way, that is very tragic, apart from what happened to them, because the English couple arrived the day after they'd gone.
Which is truly tragic.
Incredible. And they said, they saw me there. I was 15, just 15, I think. And they said they'd take me.
And this was Mr. and Mrs. Reigate?
Reigate. She was a Jewish lady, mm-hmm. but her husband wasn't. But he was a saint, as far as I'm concerned. Always will be, and always will. Anyway, Mr. and Mrs. Reigate said they'd take me back to Britain. But then we had a problem.
Because you had no passport.
Right. My mother's a very good conniver, and she somehow got our passports back. So then all I had to do was get somewhere to go, because I had nowhere to go legally.
And had Mr. and Mrs. Reigate left?
No, Mr. Reigate stayed behind, and he said he would get me some kind of sponsorship through his connections, which would get me into Britain. But in the meantime, I'd got my passport. He said, we'll need your passport to get there, but I'll also get you an affidavit, a document that'll let you in. Fine. So we, with my passport back in my hand and his escort, we went to France, expecting to get through, out and in this mm-hmm. time. When we got to Bardonecchia, they took me off the train and said my documents weren't in order. So they kept me for 48 hours in a jail.
And what did Mr. Reigate do?
He went on. He stayed a while, but he realized he couldn't stay in Bardonecchia. Mm-hmm. He went on, but I knew where he was and I knew I could contact him.
Right.
But I was sent back to Milan. And my mother, imagine being on her own by then, the family dispersed totally. Mm-hmm. And I turned up on the doorstep. She thought I was safely living in England by now. England, that was the word England. Mm-hmm. In those days, they didn't say Britain.
No.
Anyway, so I'm back in Milan, and we still want to get me out of the country. And in those days, Jewish people lived with the fact that families were split up by this refugeeism, by this system. So my mother kept struggling, and I kept struggling, and nobody would let me through, because by now I didn't have that affidavit anymore.
Right.
I just had my lousy Polish passport, which wasn't so lousy in the event. I went everywhere I could, and nobody would give me a transit visa, till I went to the Germans in despair. I went, and remember, I speak German, native German. I went there, the consulate, and I said, I would like a visa to go through Germany. And the young man said, certainly, young man, would you like to spend a little holiday in my country? Because I did not have that J in my passport. Right. In that sense, my Polish passport was my salvation. I've never had a great desire to be seen as a Pole, even, but mm-hmm. I was very lucky to have that passport mm-hmm. and that Polish situation. So they gave me a visa. I waved my mother farewell again, because she couldn't get anywhere at that time. And also she was concerned about the other son, my brother. Whilst all this was happening, my mother was struggling to find out what had happened to my brother, first of all, because he disappeared from the face of the earth. And she was in Italy, not even trying to get out, really, because she wanted to find her son. And my mother was a good contriver. She was good at getting things done. And somehow or other, and I do not know how, she found out that he had been tried and sentenced to 30 years of imprisonment for what he had done. The judge, I understand, handed down his judgment and mentioned the fact in passing he was a Jewish spy, traitor, which was true to a degree. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And he got 30 years. And he was put, as far as we know, on the Isle of Elba, which in those days wasn't a holiday camp, it was a fortress. My mother, in the meantime, managed to get to England. After war broke out, I don't know how she did it, never really found out from her, but she got into England, was kept in jail for one night and then allowed in and settled legally with the family we had right. here already. And my brother stayed in jail. And after the war, I was in the army by then, and I had a certain amount of latitude because I had a military intelligence job. Mm-hmm. I went to look for him in Italy. I found him, actually found him. And he had by then escaped from jail, of course, and the war was coming to an end in Italy. I don't know if the history that has reached you. In the middle of the war, the Italians surrendered.
Right.
So the Italian troops withdrew to the north of Italy, where the Germans were still fighting. So that was the two armies in a mess, conjoined. And my brother somehow had got out of jail. Well, probably the partisans got him out. And he fought with the partisans, actually. He became quite a hero up in the Italian mountains. And then detached himself from them. And that's when I found him in a place called Saluzzo, near Cuneo, another fortress. He'd been transferred there, first of all, and escaped from there. But anyway, after this second place, I found him. We had a great reunion, and that more or less is the end of that side of our story.
When did you arrive in Scotland, and how old were you then?
As I said, I estimate I arrived in Scotland about 1949. And how old was I? Well,
you must have been about 25 then.
That's right.
And how did you come to Scotland, and why did you come here?
Well, my mother had remarried recently, so they suggested, my mother and my stepdad, that I should come to Scotland and try my luck from here.
Was he Scottish?
No, he's not a Polish. Polish, too. But obviously, he's much, much older. He's long dead now. Mm. But he had lived here for many years.
Right. Where did you stay when you first came?
In Dunfermline, in Ayr.
What was your impression of Scotland and the people when you first arrived?
Well, I thought Glasgow was grimy but great. That's good alliteration. Mm. Grimy but great. And the people were wonderful. I didn't meet much racism. In fact, I found none. But I was aware of the hatred that the Catholics and the Protestants carried for each other and of the effect it had.
And you think it made it easier, in fact, to be something else?
Oh, yeah, they took no notice of being Jewish.
That's good. Did you mix with, well, obviously you mixed with Jewish and non-Jewish
yes.
people. With the Jewish people that you met here, did you mix with them through the refugee centre?
No, entirely independently.
Well, that's
interesting. I didn't know any refugee centres. I didn't know about the kinder transport side. So I went from Milan to the Brenner Pass, where the Italians whipped me off the train and said my papers weren't in order. And they kept me for another 24 hours. I stressed that because that 24 hours delay meant there was no one in London waiting for me. So there I was, 15 years old, skint, hungry, lonely, terrified, and no English. Not one word, not a word. And some refugee organization picked me up and took me overnight to some pretty grotty shelter. But the next morning, this limousine turned up.
So you were living with Mr. and Mrs. Reigate, and did you arrange this errand job with the German Jewish Aid Committee at Auburn House?
That was almost the same thing as I'd done in Milan. And Mrs. Reigate helped me to meet these people at Auburn House.
Right.
And I was an errand boy there again, a filing clerk.
And what age would you be by
15.
Still 15.
It's only happened over a few months.
Right, right.
I became a filing clerk and I used to run errands and do a bit of filing. And amongst my jobs was when files made up of people's cases, mm-hmm. case files. Mm-hmm. Whenever I got them, I used to have to file them in alphabetic order. And I got my mother's file. So I used to promote it to the top of the pile all
Absolutely.
The time. And that is as far as I knew. I helped her in that sense. But after mm-hmm. that, I don't know what happened. Anyway, I was errand boy. I even met the famous Lady Reigate. I think she was the wife of the vice chancellor, the Queen's representative in India.
Oh, right.
I'll think of the word for it in a minute. Anyway, she was a big shot. I remember she stopped me in the corridor, big moment of my life. And she said, "What are you doing here, young man?" By which time I knew few words of English. And I explained, and she gave me half a crown. Which was valuable. Right. I had this big silver coin in my hand. I felt rich. I'd never really had money of any kind, except pocket money from the Reigates. But I did this job till I left there to go. Next is Mrs. Reigate. Mr. Reigate were wonderful with me, but I think I must have been a little bit hard to live with. I mean, I wasn't exactly a disciplined youngster. So I dare say she got tired of me after a few months. I hate to admit it, I think she did. I used to have to prune the roses, and I didn't even do that willingly.
You were a teenager, and also you'd gone through so much getting there. I think it must have been quite a contrast to be one minute involved in really sort of survival techniques, and the next minute you meant to go back to being a boy.
A boy, exactly. That age. They had a little girl of three, and I sort of had to help look after her. There was a nanny. Mm-hmm. I mean, the household was incredibly wealthy. Incredibly wealthy. The house was in overlooking Hampstead Heath near Bishop's Avenue.
Right.
It, Wildwood Road, I think it was called. It was a stupendous house with views over the heath. And for my part, it was wonderful. I had a room to myself with shelves and shelves of books, and I like reading. I did even then. So I was quite happy, except for the roses. And I was learning my English. I must have been a pain in the tonsils. Anyway, eventually she got me a job, and that meant the end of the Woburn House job.
Right.
And I was sent to this farm in Berkshire, and that was a poultry farm. Now, I must tell you right here, I hate chickens. I hate them with a proud, undying devotion. I loathe them because of that job. It was a 16-acre farm on a very steep slope, and most of the damn chickens were at the top, and we lived at the bottom. In those days, I had shoulders. I used to carry these 100-weight bags of grain or feed or whatever up the hill, feed those loathsome animals. By that time, I would have killed them gladly. We kept on going like that. That was my life. Carry the feed up, coming back down, maybe feed the horse, whatever there was. I'm not a farm person, mm-hmm. not an animal person, so it wasn't great. I was all right with them. I did well. And Mr. Hundleby, would you believe that name, Hundleby, the farmer, took me aside one day, by which time I was managing pretty well in English, and he said, "You have been a good boy, Bert." They called me Bert. "We are going to give you rise from your half crown a week. We're going to put you up to £1 a week. And I thought, my God, I'm a millionaire.
That's, he said, that's
but,
quite
we're going, but we're going to deduct 15 shillings for board and lodgings.
Right, okay.
5 shillings. But the life was good there. I just loathed the chickens. There was an incident. The farmer had acquired some wonderful cockerels, a special breed, and he was very proud of those things. And I was told to move them from one pen to another. And you can carry them like 4 at a time if you do it the right way. And I must have damaged one of them, and it was lame. And I was terrified that I had done this damage. That's something I should have mentioned. I was living with fear all the time. I never lost my fear from Italy. Mm-hmm. And so I wouldn't even ask a copper for directions. I was terrified of most things. So I've damaged this bird. Now, don't want to tell the farmer. So I took it to a shed and thumped it over the head with a hammer, a good thump on the head, and put it in an overturned water bucket and left it. That night was a night of nightmares like I've never had before or since. I seem to remember hearing fire engines and police and God knows what coming after me. It was that. I'm sure that's imagination, mm-hmm. but that's what I remember. Anyway, next morning I went to inspect the damage, and the damn thing was still alive. So I gave it a thumping over the head procedure again, and this time it was dead. Unfortunately, the farmer had a dog, and the dog kept sniffing around that bird. I tell you, the experience of the farm was not great, except I was well fed. And then my mother, as I told you, had meantime arrived in Britain, and she'd gone to join our family in Nottingham. You know, with refugees, there tends to be a clustering.
Yep.
And our cluster was in Nottingham. My uncle was there, my aunt, several other cousins and so on. So she went to stay with them, and then when she felt that I'd had enough of the farm, she got me out of there and took me to Nottingham.
Did you work when you arrived here?
Yes, I started out as a small-time commercial traveller, working for somebody called Harold Rubin. He would probably be my step-brother-in-law.
Right.
I acquired a few of those. and he launched me, and it was only a small way, but I grew from there.
So did you remain living in the air?
No. Oh, I came back to Glasgow within months.
Right.
Within months. And I found digs here. Some digs. I won't go into it, but one or two of them were dreadful to begin with. Okay. 1945, we didn't know from recording. I used to write little reports.
After the war ended, your war ended really in 1949.
I couldn't really easily get a job. There were plenty of the mob soldiers who couldn't get jobs. But like all Jewish boys in London, I had connections. So I was offered a job in a nightclub. I was sort of the only one who could be trusted to handle the money, because the nightclub business was notoriously, yes. In those days, very
and
naughty.
And you're still?
Probably still. Anyway, so I was the main money man, and it was a fantastic life. But we worked all night, and not during the day. During the day, theoretically, I was supposed to rest. Anyway, I did that, and I also, with my sister, tried to use my DMOB money to start a little dressmaking business. That failed in short, no time at all, so that was my money gone. And that's when I came to Scotland.
So when you were working as an interrogator, what age were you then?
21, or thereabouts.
And did you have any training, or did you have any protocols?
What happened was that I was a corporal in a pioneer corps, that's the worst regiment in the British Army. A lot of us refugees were shunted into that. Some were put in the Isle of Man as prisoners, others in our case were in the army. I was promoted to corporal. I became a drill instructor to the worst scum in the British Army, the Pioneer Corps. And I kept trying to get in the intelligence corps because I had four languages by then, fluently. Obviously Italian, French, because I lived in France in the interim. English, so anyway.
German.
Mm-hmm. So, and German was an important one. So I kept trying to get in the intelligence corps and they kept rejecting me. One selection officer actually asked me if I could drive. And I said, no, sir, but I can speak four languages. He said, no, we'll teach you to become a driver. I swear to you.
It does make you wonder about the British Army.
I don't know how we won the war. So anyway, but then came D-Day.
Right.
And on D-Day, I was moved to London, to Kempton Park, which was those days' interrogation camp. I was made sergeant and became an instant interrogator. First of all, with the incoming flood of prisoners of war from D-Day, from the beaches in Normandy.
Right.
Thousands and thousands came in. And we used to have sort of question them briefly, get their records straight. There's too many of them do anything else. But when I got past the prisoner of war stage, I was put on war crimes interrogation. And that was when I felt I made a contribution. You know, we had some very nasty people.
So did you decide on your own questions? And
yes.
Were you just told,
well, we weren't even trained. But, you know, most of us, the sergeants, were in the same background as myself.
Right.
They were mostly German Jewish refugees who had landed in Britain. They might have been in the kinder transports, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
They landed in Britain, landed in the army because, like me, they wanted to be in the army. We didn't want to be foreigners, we didn't want to be whatever it was. We just, so quite a few of these sergeants with slightly foreign accents and my kind of background, well, not quite my background. Listen, you have one of these Nazis standing in front of you. You know, without even questioning what his history is, you know he's worked in a concentration camp or in a ghetto, or he's beaten up Jews, or he's that, whatever. And we worked on that principle. We prejudged. We did prejudge, there's no doubt about it. But we weren't so far wrong. And that's how I went till after the war. We still went on for about a year because the prisoners were still coming, the baddies were still coming before us. And that's why I mentioned a few names. But it was an experience and a half for a young man.
I think you must have had terrible nightmares at night as well.
Mm. For a while, I wasn't hypersensitive, because at that age, you're not.
Mm.
But I did have some, I still have occasionally, some of the people I mentioned. But altogether, the animals that came before you and tried to persuade you, they'd always loved the Jews. Their best friends were Jews. They never met anybody but Jews. The Jews were wonderful. I've written about that. They used to invite them to their picnics, like hell they did. But by that time, the Germans were our prisoners, and they lived in fear and trembling.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't always unjustified or unwarranted, because we didn't give them a very good time. No physical ill treatment, none. We didn't do that, but we still didn't make them very happy.
Mm-hmm.
The threat of imprisonment hung over their heads, and that was the thing. We were 21, 22 by then. And we had the power to make judgments. I could say, this guy's a baddie, I recommend 20 years imprisonment. They never served all that time, never, ever. Because the British Army, again, you've no idea. This higher officer thought if a German could speak English, he is a gentleman. He couldn't be bad. But meantime, we used to pass the judgment.
So when they were sentenced to imprisonment for 20 years, where would they be sent?
To camps, internment camps. We had
camps
as well.
Britain.
Yeah, and no, mostly in Germany, where
mostly
I was stationed.
Right.
I was stationed in Germany by then. No, we had camps. And what happened was, say I did, for example, interrogated them in an interrogation room. And if I thought they should be dealt with further, I passed my recommendation and the recommendation for sentence and so on. The ones we didn't consider dangerous or really wicked in the big level, we just released. And we had the power to release them as well. Right. So they knew they had to be good with us, good boys or else. Mm-hmm. But in some cases, I went as far as 30-year sentence. One or two of the people I've written about. But they weren't implemented. A year or two and they were out. And then all the Nazis were out in a year or two anyway. And that's how it turned. Eventually I got very tired of what I did. And the minute my military service ended, I quit.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That was it.
How did you meet Barbara?
Well, I was acquainted by then with a guy called Sidney Shear. He plays the piano at very often at the Jewish care. Anyway, so Sidney Shear was a close friend at that time, and one day he said, I think that is in the book, I'd like you to meet my fiancée. So we went back to the fiancée's house, and there was also this other girl sitting there in a corner working on her German homework. She was very pretty. So my German came in handy. I helped her. And we've been married happily ever after.
And how long? How many years have you been married?
1953 to, what is that, 57 years?
Once you start working, my question is, was it hard to get work? Obviously, once you started as
it was very hard to start. Very hard to start this commercial traveling.
Was it?
Visualize a young man who's pretty well lost in civilian life, going around with a little couple of cases and a few skirt samples in them, and knowing nobody. In the business, right.
So, and did it make a difference? Well, your English is very good. Do you think people knew that you'd come from abroad?
By that time, I think I still had a bit of an accent. Not much. I've never had much accent, but you could tell I came from abroad, yes.
Mm. And did that make a difference to people's attitudes?
No. They were just curious about my accent, that's all.
That's right.
And that's still going on.
And I don't hear an accent. Did you have any reason to tell the people you're working with you were Jewish, or it wasn't an issue?
It was never an issue, except with golf clubs. I couldn't get into any club. You must all know that. There wasn't one, not one club that would accept a Jew. Not necessarily for this story. When I started business, and I needed an accountant, one-man business. And one day he said, listen, Bob, why don't you play golf? I said, because nobody would take me. He said, You're laughable, that's ridiculous, it doesn't happen. I said, it happens. So he went away and came back a month later and said, Bob, I'm ashamed. I couldn't get you into my club. And that's what it was like at that time. Oh, yeah, and then I got one interesting job. My mother helped. She was a great helper, my mother. She took charge. So she remembered that there was a Nottingham man, a big manufacturer of ladies' stockings. You know the old-fashioned stockings with seams and fully fashioned. In a big way, he manufactured those. Mother went to see him and said, can you give my son a job? And he employed me. And they trained me to work this very fancy machinery, very, very long, big machine with thousands of needles doing the knitting. Only I was useless in my hands. So I broke one. And this was thousands and thousands and thousands of pounds worth. Oh, it was located in a town called Ilkeston, near Nottingham. And Ilkeston was still, I think, in the dark ages. They'd never seen a foreigner before. And nobody trusted me. Nobody wanted to talk to me. I was an enemy alien by then.
Of course, because the war was on.
Yeah. The only people who trusted me were the girls in the factory, but the men did. Mm-hmm. And my English wasn't all that good. It was hard to communicate. And when I broke that machine, I was in a doghouse. But Mr. Nosquith, that was the name of the owner, the company, by the way, was Charnas. They're still in business now. Mr. Nosquith gave me one more chance. In the interim, the guy who was sort of in charge of me came to me and said, Norbert, Bert, whatever they called me in those days, I'm getting married, will you be my best man? That was the funniest situation in my life, by the way. He didn't even like me, and I didn't like him, but he asked me because he had nobody else, I suppose. Came the day, the great day, I was dressed up in my best finery, and I remember belting up the aisle. I handed the ring to the bridegroom. I went back down the aisle to be the usher. I was usher and best man. And I went out to the car, the bridal car, and they came out. She was in a beautiful finery. I opened the car door for her. She stepped in. Then I had the door open for him, and I slammed it on his hand. I did not do much good for his honeymoon. In fact, I never knew what... I know he drove off swearing, blood-curdling swearing. I learned most... That was the last I heard of him, actually. And then I broke another machine. And even Mr. Noskov had to fire me. I mean, this was complicated machinery. Machine with all those fine needles, hundreds of needles knitting away at the same time. And for the fully fashioning bit, the machine picked up a stitch and transferred it to the next row of stitches, like in knitting. Mm-hmm. It was knitting. Anyway, so eventually, but it was knitting. Out of that factory, from a frying pan into the fire, because I got a couple more jobs. They weren't much cop, or I wasn't. Oh, one more thing that's interesting, not from my point of view. They introduced legislation that all foreigners, if they wanted to move from here to there, they had to register that they were going to... Well, Ilkeston was 7 miles from Nottingham, where my family was. So we, I was in digs in Ilkeston, terrible digs. But when I wanted to go to Nottingham for the weekend, I had to go to the police station. They had a stamp in his special book, and they wrote inside, subject entitled to move from... So the book is somewhere. I've got it somewhere, anyway. May move from Ilkeston to Nottingham for 24 hours... report. It was bloody ridiculous. We were the Polish Jews who wanted to be on the British side. Mm-hmm. We couldn't have wanted anything more. Anyway, this happened for quite some time. So every time I wanted to go to Nottingham, I got on my bike, literally, and rode the 7 miles to Nottingham, back again, get the book stamped again. Even 12 hours, stamp your book. And that went on for a while. Anyway, I got jobs in Nottingham. They were rubbish. So was I. So I mentioned I went to London. To begin with, on my own. In London, I got a job with a nice Jewish guy's two partners. It was quite a good job. I was given reasonable responsibility. It was right in the heart of London, in Poland Street, just off Oxford Street. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that was good. I lasted, made good friends. Only London was getting a shit bombed out of it. It wasn't cozy at that time. Mm-hmm. And it was an experience to see what happened to London and to hear the bombs and the sirens and the alarms, the alerts. And that is a terrible memory. Terrible memory also going to the tube stations and seeing people living there. Mm-hmm. In tents, improvised homes. Mm-hmm. And there were singing troops playing music. It was something else. That was Britain in those days. Mm-hmm. And to see those bombed out houses. Anyway. And I had this other job in London. I did it reasonably well with these people. And as I said, I kept trying to get in the army, and eventually I made it.
And I told you that. Was the British Army, it wasn't the Jewish Brigade, so that was
no,
quite
the Jewish Brigade were tough cookies.
Yeah.
No, but they came mostly out of Israel, out of Palestine.
My father-in-law was in the Jewish Brigade, that's why.
Well, you're the very, very tough guys, they were, all of them. And very, and very hero worshipped us who were not in it, so they were wonderful.
Is that right?
They helped in the capture of Tobruk, which was one of the major British victories. Dare say a lot of them joined from here, I don't know how, but it was based on Israel, I think. Anyway, so I fought my own war, which wasn't a very dangerous one because I was in the intelligence corps. In fact, I made sure I never heard a shot fired in anger. Would have been very indignant if they fired at me. So after 4 years, 2 years of which were spent on war crimes interrogation, I tell you something, that was unbelievable. I think about it now. I'm telling you, I was 21.
Mm.
A bit young for this incredibly responsible job. Now, I mean, we had some famous Nazi war criminals, some wound up in Nuremberg. There was a woman, you'll have heard of her, who came before me just for a few hours, and I allowed her to sit because she was a woman, across the desk. And she crossed her legs and tried to be very seductive. Her name was Irma Grazer. Does that mean anything to you?
Yes.
Well, when I saw her, she had beautified her as much as she could, herself, as much as she could. And she actually said to me, "What? Why? There were far too many Jews. What would you do with them?"
Because what was her job in the concentration camp?
She was deputy commandant at Belsen. Her husband, I think, was commandant. They had a family business. And her hobby was making lampshades out of human skins.
Right.
She was very notorious for that. Well, I didn't have much to do with that. I think I had some documentation prepared. She was sentenced to death. And she was hanged. And I'm told that she said, "Hurry up, boys," when she stood in the scaffold. She was really a tough cookie with a cow. And her husband got the same treatment eventually. He was hanged as well.
But she didn't try to deny what she'd done.
But she was proud of it. That she couldn't have denied it. I mean, there was she used to have the prisoners pursued by dogs. You know what happened to Jewish concentration camp inmates. They left early in the morning for work. They were marched for 2 or 3 hours, got to work, maybe a gruel for soup, for food, I mean, beaten up all day, marched back maybe 14 hours altogether, and they were dying on their feet. And when they got in, she sent set her dogs on them. She was unspeakable. Well, look, a lot of unspeakables. And that was my war.
One last question, really, about your time in Scotland. What were the highs and lows for you? Obviously, you got married, you had children.
Yes. Well, obviously, getting married was a high. 1953. We had children. Our children came, I suppose, two and four years after we married, something like that. If Barbara was here, she'd tell me I've got it wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But two or four, near enough. Yeah, and one boy, one girl. A reverse order, one girl, one boy. Yeah.
And did you get involved with working with the Jewish community in a voluntary way? I know you do now. But
in those days, no. I had no understanding of that even. Mm-hmm. I suppose like a lot of immigrants, we were concerned looking after ourselves and getting ourselves established. And I wasn't even remotely concerned with Jewish problems, except I tried to find a synagogue fairly soon. Let me make it clear, I'm not very religious, but you have to have a synagogue. And partly through that I met some people as well, of course.
Later, you were very involved with drama.
Very involved. An amateur theatre club which was of very, very high standing and standard.
Avram Green Montpellier's.
Where my wife was one of the leading ladies. But because I have no talent, I went on the management side. I was a chairman quite a while there. And that was a fantastic time for Glasgow young people all together. I think the Avon Greenman Players did wonders for drawing the community together, both in terms of spectators and workers. It really was, people don't, you're all too young to know about it, but it was quite fantastic.
That's a shame that the community's not big enough really now, I think.
It wasn't big enough. Also, television became a serious competitor. And kids didn't want to go out in the dark in the winter to rehearse when they could sit at home watching the old-fashioned television box.
Mm-hmm. Would you say that Judaism has been significant in your life?
Totally. Totally. Now, anyway, to me, it's all about being Jewish, but it's always been the persecution, the running away, the persecution, the running away, and then coming to this lovely Jewish community, which was and is a lovely Jewish community, and very supportive of me, not in the sense of charity, but the sense of being supportive and kind and helpful. Yes.
Remind me what your book's called, Bob, because I'm sure
Over My Shoulder.
And why is it called Over My Shoulder?
Looking back. What I'm doing with you just now.